Today on Executive with a Cause, I welcome Carrie Leeson, the CEO of Lifeline Camera and Beacon Group Australia, as we chat about the good, the hard, the scary things about running not just a charity, but a social enterprise at the same time. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. Oh, we've known each other for a while now. You at CEO of Lifeline, and I was the CEO at RSBCA ACT about the same time we took those new jobs, didn't we?
I remember the early days. We would huddle together in support of one another.
I still have scars from those days. I'm sure you do too.
What have we done?
But it's been a few years now since you've been in that role, and I know a lot has changed. For those that don't know anything about Lifeline Canberra, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, look, it's an incredible organization, as you know. It's an organization that exists to support individuals in crisis or having thoughts of suicide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's anyone of any age. So we're there to lend a supportive ear. And of course, the organization also extends its crisis support into face-to-face services as well. We do a lot of prevention around training and education. And we do a lot of face-to-face in the bereavement space as well, post loss of life.
I always said I couldn't do your job. I find it just emotionally, just thinking about your cause is significant. And how many people do you have working for you?
The organization itself relies heavily on volunteers. So of the 800 strong workforce we have, the size of the team, almost 750 of them, if not more, are unpaid.
Wow.
So it's a very small team that we have on the payroll, and their role is to facilitate, support, recruit, train, offer supervision, clinical supervision, that is, and run our events and fundraising arm.
Yeah, not a small job at its core, is
no,
it?
No, no.
For the volunteers, are they mostly those that are answering the helpline?
Half and half almost at this point in time. So we've got around a 50-50 split. When I say 50-50, around 360, 380 active crisis support volunteers, those are individuals that are doing their fortnightly shift of 4 hours a week. It's no small undertaking. And the other half roughly are our book fair and warehouse volunteers. So either sorting through donations at the warehouse or being present to support and help facilitate the book fairs themselves, so interacting with the public to give all of those books and items a good home.
Yeah, I think your book fair is really unique as a fundraiser itself, and I think that would be something that other places might be interested in exploring a little bit more. Can you talk about exactly what that is?
The book fairs?
Yeah.
They're an institution, almost an iconic event here in Canberra, and we are slowly growing them around the country as well and supporting other centres as they get their book fairs up and running. Essentially, the book fair itself is an event that was set up to fundraise for Lifeline Canberra for the crisis support line. It's almost as old as Lifeline Canberra itself. It's about 2 years younger. So Lifeline Canberra turned 50 this year, and the book fairs are around 48 years old. The book fair started in a volunteer's garage and has now obviously evolved with the amount of support and donations that we receive. We've become synonymous with donations when people are donating books or puzzles, DVDs, vinyl records, collector's items. And so all of those will go through now a warehouse sorting facility. And the process on the back of incredible volunteers who give of their time is astounding. It's really well run. And all of those items are then sort of cleaned up, categorized, priced and palletized and stored very safely for our book fairs, which happen 2 to 3 times a year. Outside of COVID, of course, and as you know, we have had to pivot into other exits for those books or other ways to sell them. But the book fairs themselves are very, very, very much a part of the Canberra landscape and fabric.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to paint a picture if you haven't seen them. But picture just absolute, airplane hangars full of used books and puzzles and DVDs, like you said, going in there and buying a book that. Here in Australia, it can be a $30 book, and you pay a couple dollars for it.
Mm.
Great way to recycle.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure those books stay out there. And I've certainly have gone through there many, 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 many times, as most Canberrans have been.
Yeah.
What percentage of your revenue is generated through the book fairs themselves?
Initially, so when I started in the role, it was around maybe 80 to 85%
wow.
of the organization's income. It's now closer to 40 to 45%. We have done a lot of work on the back end operationally to diversify our revenue and our income stream, our commercial operations. And that's paying dividends, obviously, in terms of sustainability. And as we've had to adjust to the environment and what has happened over the last couple of years, we've been able to sustain ourselves and grow to meet the demand on the crisis support line. So
yeah,
it's a little bit lower now. Yeah.
Well, you know, you just talked about diversifying your revenue. I know there is another organization that is, it's a social enterprise, I think, isn't that right? Or is it a not-for-profit as well, the Beacon Group?
Beacon Group is a not-for-profit.
It's
yeah,
a not-for-profit.
Social impact, yep, but
okay.
not-for-profit.
All right. So Beacon Group Australia, that has been something that you've brought forward from your own ideas and initiatives. Can you tell us a little bit more about that organization? Because you're the CEO of that as well.
Yes. It's my sandpit. So essentially, Lifeline is a very well-known brand and is a very trusted brand in Australia. It is very clear on its mission and its vision and what it seeks to achieve for the Australian community. So, of course, when you start to create or diversify or respond to community needs, they may well fall outside of the scope of work for that organisation. It's also very important, and we might get to this further on in the discussion, when you are actually working within a federated structure or working within a brand in a social franchise model or otherwise, it's important to understand very, very intimately where the IP is created, where it belongs, who owns it, just to ensure that you are protecting the work that you're creating. And that ultimately is for the end cause, which is to ensure that you're able to continue to support those in crisis, as is the case at Lifeline. So Beacon Group was established essentially for that purpose, just to allow us to go out and around the brand, but always in support of the brand, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And is it mostly just products and licensing in that particular organization?
At this stage, so it's got big plans. It's something that isn't bound by the licensing agreements or the service agreements within Lifeline itself. Mm-hmm. So again, as I mentioned, it allows us to go out and around and respond to immediate need without all the potential bureaucracy or licensing issues that you might have within a bigger organization where it's harder to move quickly for good reason. And that's where the trust comes in, because of the fact that that organization, Lifeline, is so entrenched. But the organization that is Beacon Group allows us to be really agile, to try new things, to take risks, and to find ways to generate revenue, to find ways to change the conversation around mental health, and to be where we're needed very quickly.
Mm. Well, what a nice way to create some freedom for yourself. Because I think, like you said, you know, when you're part of a federation structure, and I know this is not as familiar in other parts of the world, but in Australia, if you're part of Lifeline Canberra, you're part of Lifeline Australia, you have sister organizations, you might have a parent organization. I know locally in this country, there's been a lot of mergers and acquisitions to try to combine states and reduce the overhead cost. But it does have both benefits and disadvantages from that. And I suppose with Beacon Group, it sounds like you are creating a way to get past some of those disadvantages of being constrained by that that federated model. If somebody else was a part of similar organization structure, what were the kind of the decisions that led you to believe that it was time to go ahead and set up a separate organization to do those types of things?
Mm. It wasn't something that we did straight out of the gate. It took a number of years to ascertain that that was the best route to go. I think understanding what your organizational priorities are when you come into a well-known, trusted brand, understanding what it is that you can do within the confines of that and still achieve the outcomes, because things are changing all the time on the legislation front, on the workers' treatment or WH&S front, for example. So understanding compliance and governance as a part of that tapestry as well is so important. And I think what we had to do essentially with Lifeline Canberra initially was focus on sustainability. The organisation itself was in a precarious position financially, having lost significant funding streams from the government. And so our priority then wasn't to start to create, it was really just to consolidate and to try and stop the bleeding. What we needed to do then is very, very quickly establish income revenue streams, and what I focused on there initially was that expense reduction, as well as trying to build a relationship and a presence and a relevance in the Canberra community again. It is an organisation that has been around for many years, and people anticipate it will be around for many years to come. What they don't necessarily have access to or full visibility of is how we're funded, and that is something that we are trying to protect and ensure that we manage accordingly. So that idea for Beacon Group came about around 3 or 4 years in, and there was often multiple attempts to work within the brand without understanding necessarily what the consequences, intended or unintended consequences, would be of going down certain paths. So there was a lot of engagement with Lifeline Australia and the rest of the network before we established that, look, it was going to be good for everyone if we moved certain projects outside of the Lifeline brand. And obviously that's worked really well for us. We've got international connections now, and Beacon Group is increasing, I guess, in terms of its impact on the back end. Lifeline is a very visible brand. Beacon Group is very much in the background supporting it.
And I think a common issue here in Australia is that a lot of people think these not-for-profits are heavily supported by government without actually understanding how much work is involved to keep these programs running. For just the pandemic by itself, like, what kind of support have you been giving to the general public, and how has that changed because of the pandemic?
Initially, in that first couple of hours, was obviously a lot of talk with the ministers to ensure that we had essential services status so we can continue to run, because we saw an enormous increase in the number of individuals reaching out to the crisis support line almost immediately post the initial lockdown. That was following in Canberra the floods and the storms, and also the bushfires nationally. So we were already run off our feet in terms of trying to meet the call demand. The impact, I guess, of the pandemic was that we had to go virtual. So we started to test various models to allow our volunteers to work from home, and Lifeline Canberra was the test centre for that. It was deemed not the best way to go forward because we were unable to be reassured of the clinical supervision model and the psychosocial safety of our crisis supporters. So we're very much about ensuring that we don't harm one person to help another. And that's a very much a part of our leadership ethos. It flows right through the organisation in terms of our values. So initially, we had to look at what we were going to do in terms of how we were going to meet the demand. But what we saw, to answer your question straight out the gate, was a very large increase in the number of people reaching out for help. We never anticipated, obviously, the increase being around 40% over and above what we were already achieving. And of course, it created an additional, angle or dimension in that our crisis supporters were now living this crisis themselves. Mm-hmm. So we had individuals living a Lifeline call and being on the phone to support others in crisis as well, because of course life was still happening to individuals on top of the pandemic. It became very complex very quickly.
And are you also constrained by the same things that other charities and not-for-profits have been dealing with, which is the fact that they have an aging volunteer group, which means that they're part of the more vulnerable crowds, and that means that their ability to come in and support the organization as a volunteer might be restricted to becoming to remote only. Were you also constrained by the same, demographics that may be impacted by the pandemic?
On our crisis support arm, that isn't the case.
Okay.
We have individuals of every age who were vulnerable for different reasons. So it really became an issue around who was available and capable, and it reassuring them that the processes in place would ensure their safety. Again, not knowing initially what the pandemic meant, whether it was something that was going to cost someone their life or their livelihood or their health for a matter of days, weeks or months. We didn't know much. It really was about shutting down the risk and keeping everyone safe initially. So our teams took on the initial response. Out at the warehouse, yes, it tends to attract an older or a retired individual because it's much more relaxed. It's a community out there. The vibe is different. The value proposition is different. The volunteering experience is different. What we find on the crisis support line is we've got everyone who from university age. Uh-huh. Those students studying psychology come through and do the crisis. It's an accredited course.
Oh, wow.
So they do the training as part of their education. And right through to, you know, your mums, your dads, and your retirees, visiting ambassadors, partners, for example. So it's a really mixed bag. But what we found out very quickly is we couldn't make assumptions around age and vulnerability because we realized that people were vulnerable irrespective of their age.
Yeah. Mm. And how do you, and just generally, not just through the pandemic, but in general, you have a lot of volunteers doing in the warehouse physical things with lots of heavy books. You have staff answering suicide prevention calls that I imagine can cheer them up quite quickly if they're not in the right headspace themselves. How do you protect your own staff from the nature of the work that you guys do?
Me personally, I think it's part of my leadership style is I won't ask anyone to do anything I'm not willing to do myself. So I've been in most areas of the business as a volunteer. I started on the crisis support line myself as a crisis supporter. I've been on the board and now as a member of the paid team and staff at Lifeline. And I went back with the warehouse right back to the beginning and found one of the incredible humans who set up the book fair and sought to understand from the beginning what the mission was, what the objective was, how they went about it, what's special about it, because some of the volunteers at the warehouse have been there for 30, 35, 40 years. So to come in as someone relatively new on both sides of the organization, it was important to understand what I was asking of people. And that's the cultural side of it. That's the social, the psychosocial side of it. The health and safety side in terms of a physical sense, it's really about making sure you understand what it is you're asking of people, what the risks are, and mitigating all of those as best you can. And not just once or twice, but having ongoing processes and a culture that is around people's safety, both physically and emotionally.
I think the processes that you guys have put in place to do that is probably something that a lot of other organizations lack. The systems and processes are absolutely key to having consistent results, and yet most places don't even have them documented. If somebody were to be listening to the show right now and is trying to think about ways that they can improve their organization, would this be one area that you'd have them focus on first, or are there other things that you would think about to say, look, you know, obviously you got to bring in money, but if you don't get this part right, then, you know, you're not going to be able to deliver the services?
I think it's important to understand what you're coming into and what the priorities are. I wouldn't necessarily say it was the first thing I focused on was our policies and procedures, because we were literally in crisis ourselves financially. Yeah. So it became about focusing on that. I think it is a vital part of running an organization. And unfortunately, because of resourcing, because of the fact that quite often a hand-to-mouth existence is synonymous with the charity sector, individuals just don't have the capacity or the time or the connections to be able to get the back end as robust. So you either focus on the brand and building the brand or the cause, and a lot of people come in very passionate. And that can often be the catalyst to creating a foundation or a really good charity, but it's not what sustains it.
Mm.
You do need, and I'm not one for detail to be stuck in policies and processes, but even I will appreciate that they are very, very necessary, not just for safety and security and for compliance and insurance purposes, but understanding that there are so many individuals that need that detail in your organization. Mm-hmm. So whilst they may not respond to your leadership style, they take a lot of safety and security from the policies and the processes. And that's a beautiful thing about Lifeline, is we've got that safe environment. So when you create a safe environment, emotionally and physically for individuals, that's where they're able to shine and do their best and thrive and then actually contribute back to the culture.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a safety first, whether it's financial, reputational, mm-hmm. or otherwise. Yeah.
Yeah. Operational risk is obviously has to be first priority more than anything, even if it's other things are falling apart.
Yeah.
Are you using any kind of tools or automations to help you deliver things systematically?
We are. We didn't have the means to do anything too flash or fancy initially, and so we relied heavily on our website and obviously on the back end, our accounting package. That was all we had. We've now evolved, now that we have a very good read on the community that we're serving, individuals' engagement, preferences and habits, and that's been afforded to us through just analytics on the back end with data, through social media and through engagement, just really getting an understanding of what we're doing and what the consequences are of that. And we now have a series of platforms, electronic, online, that just assist us in ensuring that we're accurate on the compliance side, but also we're engaging regularly and getting our message out consistently on the front end or on the relationship building side. So, and everything in between. Obviously, there's been migrations to the cloud, this miraculous thing that exists that I don't particularly understand. Very much hands off when we went from a hard, we actually turned our hard system off yesterday. Our server went down, and we prayed that everything would stay up and running in the air, up in our cloud, and it has, fingers crossed. We lost internet connection for a couple of seconds, but I think it's important to keep evolving, because understanding if you want to stay relevant, not just in terms of people reaching out for crisis support for our organization, but your service, but also stay relevant in terms of your compliance and your governance and legislation, you need to be moving with the times, as uncomfortable as that is.
Yeah. And it's getting harder, isn't it? Like, there's so much information that you have to be able to put into something to keep track of all the actions and compliance requirements and regulations that are changing, as you say. Are there any resources that you use now, just in general as an executive to, become better? Things that you rely on, could be podcasts or books or anything like that?
I was going to say coffee.
I think that's number one for most.
Don't talk to me until I've had my coffee. I think this role, again, my role is so people-oriented. I'm very comfortable with the fact that I can adopt and adapt new systems and processes on the back end. I don't rely on any, I would say. I'm very much about understanding what a lifeline means to individuals. And how to break down the barrier between an individual in crisis and them reaching out to Lifeline for help. Mm-hmm. It doesn't often require something technical. It just requires empathy and understanding and engagement. And I'm quite dogged in my approach around trying to understand that and create that understanding, because I think what we're seeing, especially coming out of this pandemic, is the remaining sort of the hangover, I'm calling it, the COVID hangover. People are still so uncertain. They're still so anxious. And I'm one of those people too. And how we're managing it, we need to be roadmaps for one another. So for me, I think it's important, even though we're using those systems on the back end, we don't hang our hat on them or promote them, because it's really about the human interface. Mm-hmm. But all of that makes it so much easier to be present and to focus and to go away and do something great with that information.
I think your psychology background is probably really useful for your job as well, with just the number of stakeholders you have to deal with. You have so many volunteers. I know that organizations that are heavily reliant on volunteers have a totally different perspective of human resources than those that are heavily reliant on staff. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you do differently to manage volunteers versus staff?
No. I would say, obviously, the requirements around what you're obligated to communicate and it varies. So there are, but our value, how we show value, how we recruit, engage, and support individuals is very, very, very similar. It's obviously there are legislative differences between the two and requirements, obligations, compliance, governance on the back end, but how we essentially manage and engage is very, very similar.
Yeah. Mm. You know, right now there's a lot of talk about the Great Resignation, and mostly people are thinking about corporations when they think about that, but not-for-profits are under the same constraints and sometimes greater because of their ability to pay maybe standard market rates. What do you do to attract good people to your organization? Because there's no way you can run two organizations as CEO without having great people underneath you.
Mm-hmm. We are very, very clear on the organization and what it means, what its value is to the community that we're in, and what it means to be a part of that team. The best thing I can do is create an organization that people want to be a part of and then be very clear on what it takes to be compatible with that organization. I think we find when we're recruiting, and a lot of organizations are, they're looking for capability. So they're looking for someone who can do the job. And that's what the recruitment process focuses on, and the resume and the interview process. What is very, very difficult to determine, what often lets people down in the charity space, is compatibility. So not understanding what it's going to be like doing accounts, for example, when you've got very traumatic content coming across your desk, either incidentally through conversations in the hallway or on your email, because things are obviously communicated in certain ways. So understanding your compatibility with the organization, give people something very clear in terms of what the organization is and what they're getting into, and then assist them in becoming compatible, whether it's with the shift work, whether it's with the content, whether it's with their colleagues. Obviously, we have a broad range of personalities as well, and quite often we find that's what lets people down, because it's a very stressful environment. Mm-hmm. It's a first responder style organization, and I think the best thing you can do is to clarify and present a very clear vision, mission, values, and then ensure that the individual knows that part of their performance is actually becoming compatible with the organization. And the difficult thing there, or the difference there between a paid employee and a volunteer, is that sense of connection. They are equally bound to the organization for that reason and that common purpose, we find, but sometimes it's the salary that keeps an individual there, or an entitlement, or a commitment, or a loss. So what drives the individuals is quite different, and how you communicate is quite different. So how we recruit is different across the organization, and we do ask for different levels of commitment as well, because that's also something. You've got capability, compatibility, and commitment. And you might require more or less commitment depending on what you're asking people to do.
So define commitment for me. Is that based on a contract on expecting them to stay for so many years? Does that mean obligations on weekends? I mean, what exactly do you mean when you talk about commitment?
I think where you're paying someone, you can rely less on commitment. Mm-hmm. They're there to very clearly perform tasks and a role, and for a financial outcome. Mm-hmm. Everything over and above that is the culture you create that ensures that they're enjoying their life and their time with you. And often your role as a leader is to get the best out of people and to support them on to bigger and better things, either within your organization or outside of it. With the volunteer, it's actually very, very different. You're asking for a time commitment. You're asking them to give of their time. There's no financial benefit to them. It's all heart. And they're coming to you because they're either passionate about leaving their organization or the community better than they find it, or they're coming to you because they've suffered with a loss themselves, or they're coming to you because they've gone through something and they want to prevent someone else going through it. So understanding very, very unique drivers helps you to determine what commitment means and what you're asking for, mm-hmm. and how you facilitate that and how you grow it. But I think we're very fortunate at Lifeline. No one wants to imagine a world without Lifeline in it.
Yeah, for sure.
So that commitment is there. Everyone that walks through that door understands what Lifeline does, loves the work that it does, respects it and trusts it. So that commitment's very easy to forge. Beacon Group will be different. We're not at the stage yet where commitment is a key component to organizational success. We're still building its capability and its personality.
Yeah. You talked a lot about culture. I know in my previous roles that you rely so heavily on gut instincts when you're interviewing somebody about whether or not there's a culture fit. I don't know if that's the same for you, but I do know that you took quite a while to pick your new general manager to help you out, since you have these two CEO hats on. What do you do for trying to identify cultural fit? Because it is really hard to document.
Mm-hmm. Again, I see my role being the voice of Lifeline Canberra. And I often will frustrate my team members when I say to them, I'm the voice of this organization. Imagine it sitting in the room. And when someone is behaving in a way or conducting their business or their role in a way that is harming the organization doesn't talk back. Do it to a colleague and there's feedback. So quite often I position myself as the voice of the organization, and I try and explain how what they're doing is having consequences, intended or unintended, for Lifeline Canberra. So for me, the role of GM, it was so important that this individual knew what Lifeline Canberra required of it. That was the role, rather. The individual themselves needed to bring a level of commitment to forging strong relationships within the team, understanding the culture, where we were going, but also what the current team needed was a very, very challenging task. And we took 8 months to find this individual, because you've also got to understand succession. You need to understand the pain that individuals might have gone through COVID, and the losses, the people that we lost during that time. So it was really about looking at what this individual needed to be. And it was a very, very unique and special individual that eventually snaffled the role. And because we took the time and we gave them space and read the room in terms of how they onboarded themselves or how we helped them onboard, I'm very pleased to say it's going very, very well.
Yeah. Did you ever get to a point where you thought, oh, this isn't working, we're just going to have to do something else, or pick someone who's kind of fits the needs but not quite what you had in mind? Did you ever get to that point of disparity where you thought, we can't wait any longer?
I didn't. I think, again, if I had, it'd be a different – we probably did start to see that being the situation on the horizon. Mm-hmm. So being able to anticipate that risk was there and growing – you're always managing risks, aren't you? And so I think during COVID, we had a number of our operational requirements drop off or freeze, pause, or die altogether because we were unable to deliver. So it freed up capacity for me to be able to jump into other areas. And I really cherish the last couple of years for that reason. It threw me into the operations of our core services and allowed me to then reappreciate, redefine, reiterate, and then come out of it a little bit wiser before just simply filling the role. It never got to that point, fortunately for us, but I imagine for some people it does, because quite often in the charity sector, you're asking for big things, but you've only got a very small budget to be able to afford it. So you're relying a lot on passion and commitment.
Yeah. Well, it's good you're seeing some positives from that, because I know your team has had, such a challenging time during this period, and it's not over. I think a lot of people are thinking, because lockdowns have ended so far in Australia, knock on wood, that these crisis centers, like what you guys are doing, there's less need. Is that a fallacy?
Well, it's hard to know. I've often tried to provide the information, because it's a very important question, but we're so busy in the response stage that we haven't had a chance to look up, not since 2019. And obviously before that, but if we look at when the pandemic, if we define it by the pandemic dates, we obviously, as I mentioned, had the bushfires, the storms, and then the pandemic itself. So it's very, very hard to understand what will happen. We're still trying to come to terms with what has happened, but certainly themes emerging. We can see with absolute clarity that more people are reaching out for help than ever before, and when they do reach out for help, their situation is much more complex. So whether they've left it longer, whether COVID has added a complexity, or whether these individuals are reaching out for the first time and have a lot of work to do, we're still trying to ascertain. We're seeing younger people using the service, younger and younger over the COVID period. So what we're anticipating is absolutely an increase in the number of mental health challenges that individuals will face, and for at least the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing a decline in the call answer rate every single day. We went from 2,500 calls a day on average pre-pandemic to now well over 3,500 on average per day. And that hasn't declined because, of course, we've got the floods. Yeah. And we've got, you know, people continuing to feel isolated, struggling with financial distress, relationship breakdowns, addictions, alcohol abuse or misuse. Mm-hmm. Those crises are all still happening. So we don't see a direct correlation between lockdowns disappearing and the call answer rate declining. In fact, it's going up.
Yeah, interesting. So it's hard to talk about what you guys do for your mission without feeling a little bit, sad to know that the services are needed even more so. Is there anything positive in the horizon that you can see for the workload that you have in front of you that you're like, yeah, that's actually, you know, a positive step in the right direction rather than just responsive to the community needs?
Mm. There's always hope. I mean, we're an organization that is based on the fact that there is hope, and we hold on to that from a philosophical standpoint. Operationally, there is a lot more we can do and are doing, and I think it's about looking at what is being done in the space and collaborating. I came in very, very green into the charity sector from the private sector and thought collaboration was just the way to go. As you know, it's not only because of the funding issues that preclude that collaboration piece, because it puts people's funding potentially at risk. So you do things too well, too quickly, too efficiently, and you can see a change to your funding. So that is something that we discovered very early on. So what it's doing is creating this environment where we've just got so many not-for-profits being established because they want to do something a little bit differently or in a different way. So I think what we are doing is looking at, again, reascertaining what the needs are, who's left standing at this point in time, who's able to deliver what, and then trying to determine a program or a way forward. And we're always coming in with an evidence-based approach as well. So I think there's a lot to be done and a lot we can empower individuals to do to prevent the reliance on services as well.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to have to do, start to depend on each other again.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Full plate. And going back to your comment about just the number of charities that have started up in the sector, I think I just saw a number recently that says there's 600,000 not-for-profits and charities in Australia alone.
Wow.
And, you know, if you look at the social enterprise sector, that's growing as well. And then you think more globally, it's significant. And with a population here locally of only 25 million people, but having that many charities surely does not have any kind of sustainability. For people that are perhaps part of not-for-profits and executives and are thinking about starting one, what advice would you give them in terms of whether or not that's a good idea, whether or not they look at sustainability, whether or not they think about merging with another organization? What's your view on that and just general advice?
It's a tough one. You look at why charities are formed. It's often on the back end of someone's experience, and they're trying to prevent that from happening to anyone else. So how you curtail that, or how you trim that down or trim that back to a conversation around impact and true impact, consequences, and I think is quite difficult, because a lot of these foundations are formed in the wake of grief and loss or challenges, significant challenges. I would say in a perfect world, like anything else, if you were starting up a private sector company and you wanted to make oodles of cash, for example, which is typically why organizations exist in the private sector, is look at the same but change out the content. Look at impact, look at the number of people, not the number of dollars, but the number of people impacted, and make sure what you're doing is going to affect or have the greatest income. So if you place it on I'll talk about the balance sheet of life, take out the dollar signs, place in hearts or feelings or lives saved in our case, and wherever you're going to get maximum net, go with that approach. And it may not mean starting up a business from scratch. It may mean taking your concepts and your ideas and collaborating, partnering, and joining forces with someone else, or simply handing the concept over if you know it's going to be done better.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very difficult thing to do, but it's a very altruistic space as well. And as you know, and I know, is a lot of sharing that happens and a lot of common experience that bonds us and allows us to assist one another through challenges. So I would say try and remove the content, the trauma and the emotion, mm-hmm. and look at it as a business prospect. Look at it as a cold, calculating entity or operation, and make sure that what you ultimately want to achieve is maximum impact, is as a result of you setting up a new company or not.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. It's great advice. I mean, financially, I don't think people recognize how difficult it is to run a not-for-profit. It is the biggest challenge. And I like the fact that in Australia, we use the word not-for-profit rather than in America where it's a non-profit, because it kind of reminds you that it's not that you don't have a bottom line surplus every year. It just means that you're not, you know, that's not your aim.
Mm.
And it's the number one reason why most not-for-profits will fail, right? So just to wrap up a few extra questions, mm-hmm. I think that your role has changed so much since you brought on the general manager. How do you spend your time now? Like, how would you say in a general week would you spend, say, on people management versus strategy versus other things that you're doing?
Mm. Just like on the crisis support line, no two calls, no 2 days are the same. I live from day to day. My role at this point is, as I said, to understand, is to go ahead, to go as far out and scout and see what's left, what's remaining, what do people need, what's the sentiment, where is our revenue going to come from? How do we sustain ourselves? Where are we needed? So I think it's about forming a very rich picture at this point. And my role will continue to evolve. So as I mentioned, I've gone from a very operational, hands-on space to now understanding the rich picture that exists post-COVID. So it's a very much a systems thinking approach. There are new stakeholders. There are new consequences to doing things the same way. The situations have changed. The complexity on the phone lines has changed as well, has heightened. The demand has increased. And whilst demand is such an important driver in the private sector, what it means in the not-for-profit sector is something very, very different. It means that people are unable to live their best lives. People are suffering. People are struggling. So there's a lot of pressure to make sure that what you're doing is having the right impact on the individuals that need it most. So my role right now is really, it's engagement. We are making sure that as and when we try and get operations back up and running, as you would have seen recently with the book fair, we're seeing new challenges emerging. Never in my wildest dreams, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago, would we have anticipated that a Lifeline book fair would need to be shut down because of protests. Yeah. And so
not related to the book fair, by the way.
No, there's normally a very sizable queue. I think it's about 2,000-3,000 people before the doors open. But yeah, very, very different operating environment. People's expectations of the organization have changed. It's really, really important that I understand that. Mm-hmm. Because whatever we do strategically, whatever strategy the board sets for me, I need to ensure that I digest that and set in place operational processes that match the strategy but meet the need that's out there at the moment. Mm-hmm. So it's just understanding that system and understanding the consequences of doing one thing over another. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where we're having to triage services and triage individuals. And hopefully we find ourselves in a world one day where we don't have to do that. That's the mission. That's what I'm trying to focus on at the moment.
Such a nice space right now, I think, for you to be able to finally step back a little bit from ops and have that strategic view. Because I know that, you know, when you're head down, bum up type thing, it is really hard to get your head space that you need to make significant decisions. And it sounds like because of this new role that you've been able to create and the right person in that role, that you're now in a very good place for really thinking about the future of this organization. And it's brilliant. I love that. Some of the people that are listening may be involved in not-for-profits themselves. I would think so because of the topic. They may be executives as well. What advice would you give them if you only had a couple of words of wisdom to say that if you wanted to run a better not-for-profit or charity, what three things would you give someone you were mentoring if it could only be like a sentence long?
One sentence. I would say, look, I've stumbled across something that I think is probably just feels like a best kept secret. But really, if you can get it right, you're not going to look back. And I think for me, it's about operations and strategy. So often strategy, and I'm going to use more than one sentence. So often strategy is something that the board set, and it's a document that's printed and it looks amazing and it sounds incredible and it goes on a shelf. As the leader of an organization, CEO, GM, whatever your role title might be, you need to take that strategy and translate it into operations. And if you do that, you essentially will create an organization that no matter what individuals are doing, whether it's turning on the kettle, opening the door, answering the phone, whatever they do on that particular day drives energy into the strategy and executes your vision and your mission. So it's the board's role to make sure that the vision and the mission link to strategy. And all you need to do is make sure that your operations, your reporting columns, what you're asking your team to do, everything you ask your team to do, in some way, shape, or form, links up with one of those strategic columns. Do that, and we're all going on holidays.
Yeah, no, magic right there.
Yeah,
I think that's great advice, and probably a budget that supports all those things as well. I think that's also the missing piece that a lot of people forget to align that.
Finances are always a column in the strategy. Sustainability, that's what allows you to plan ahead. That's what allows you to attract the right people, maintain and keep the culture that you want as well. Unfortunately, yes, finances, and it often can be something that's seen as evil in the not-for-profit sector. As you say, not-for-profit, I learned a very, very, very clear lesson in the first few months in my role when someone said not-for-profit does not mean loss.
Yeah.
Know that. You don't need to bleed or be a bleeding heart financially. Your mission and your message is enough. Make sure you're sustainable financially.
Yeah, and you're very good at that part of it. So I think we have a lot of lessons to learn from you. All right. If anyone wants to learn more about Lifeline Canberra or Beacon Group Australia, what's the best place to send them to?
Yes, our website, of course. All of our numbers and our links are on there, lifelinecanberra.org.au.
Great. Thank you, Kerry. I think your learnings from, I mean, not just what you're doing now at Lifeline, but also what you've done in the past has obviously influenced your approach to taking this organization to the next level. I'm really interested to see what you do with the Beacon Group in the future, because I think it does have, you know, not just a lot of commercial promise, but like you said, it can extend beyond the local realms of one community of Canberra and probably outlying areas that you support now and go well beyond that. And it's pretty amazing to watch you in such a very stressful role, you know, be able to go from strength to strength. So thank you for your time today and all the work that you and your team does.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. So this week I have a question from a client, and in our segment of IT in plain English, the question is, what's the difference between servers, virtual servers, and the cloud? So the basic question is, a server is kind of like a computer. It looks much like a desktop, just a lot more powerful. And as you would expect, it holds applications and data. But I want to give it to you in plain English, so I'm going to give you a different analogy. I want you to picture a server to be kind of like a carry-on luggage. And the carry-on luggage has space for various things, and you want to put information in it. So it could be maybe it's physical books. You'll take your old records, music records. You'll take your perhaps little video games, and you could put them all into your luggage. But then you realize you actually have space. So someone next to you, one of your friends or colleagues, says, hey, can you also hold some of my information because I don't have a place for it? And you say, sure, let's do that. But I want to make sure I know what's my information and what's your information. So you basically put in some packing cubes and you put all your information in this little cube and you put all their information in this other cube. Now, that's kind of like a virtual server. You basically have one computer or one piece of luggage holding different pieces of information and applications. So what exactly is a cloud? Well, let's think about it as a storage unit that you can hire down the street where you can pay a monthly fee. Now, if you want to, you could take your luggage with all your information and just put it into a locker and you pay a monthly fee. if your luggage ever gets old or broken, you have to replace it yourself, but at least it's kind of securely locked up in there and you no longer have to keep it in your house or in your car. Now, that's what we call a private cloud. And then the last one is, which is more common these days, is that you don't actually want to look after your luggage. You don't want to replace it when everything's break or a newer bottle comes upon, or you need more luggage. So instead, what you do is you just hire, from a monthly point of view, you just hire space in the cloud. And a cloud essentially is a big old building with a bunch of computers in it that you don't own. And all you do is rent space for your information and applications. So there you are. IT in plain English, hopefully that was understandable for your knowledge, and hopefully my client was happy with that answer as well. If you do have a question about IT in general, that's what I do for a living, please connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a question, and I might just answer it on this podcast. If you liked what you heard and saw today, then please make sure you subscribe. Leave a review as well so we can continue to have this show. And for those of all of you out there who are executives with a cause, I just want to remind you that what you're doing right now is great, that this world is a better place because of what you and your team are doing, and you just keep on doing that. So thank you for your work. Cheers.